Welcome to Now You Know, a podcast designed and developed to take the controversial and complicated questions facing both faith and the Catholic Church, and giving ourselves the space and time to explore and come to a deeper understanding of these topics. My name is Father Cody Williams, and I am your host for this podcast. Is there any evidence for God or Jesus? I'd like to start with this quote. For those who believe, no amount of proof is necessary. For those who do not believe, no amount of proof is sufficient. I think this quote shows a lot of the challenges, difficulties, and also the direction that this particular conversation will go. First of all, it seems to center around the idea that if you have belief, it doesn't really matter. Evidence is not the core element of belief. And if you don't believe, nothing's going to prove it. Nothing's going to make you believe. Now, for this particular topic, I want to challenge this notion for a moment that belief is all that there is. Belief is the core of any type of ascribing to God or Jesus. But I do want to ponder the question, is there evidence for God or Jesus? Is there evidence to suggest he's there, maybe not to the level of believing, but at least to the idea that, yeah, these kind of line up to something different than what we'd anticipate? This question is rather important in a more broad perspective on our society. As we wrestle and debate these kind of issues of theology and as well as religion and religious beliefs, we do come to this core that if we all kind of had one religious belief, wouldn't we all kind of agree on things? Largely not true. Or as we wrestle with the pluralism of our society, that we all have different beliefs, how do we come to some core foundational values? How do we get to some point where we can talk on the same language? The goal of this particular question is to start to get our mind around this idea of evidence. And what is evidence? What does it mean for us? How do we grasp it? What does it mean to prove something? Maybe there's more to life than what I anticipated. So the most central point of this particular question is evidence. And that's where I want to start. What is the difference between evidence and proving? Because ultimately, this is very, very important. Evidence suggests things that relate to it. Proving is everyone should believe. So let's start with this idea. In our modern society, we have a desire to prove, to really make sure our claims are absolutely valid, that everything we've said has been validated and given as much evidence as possible to the point where everyone would agree with it. We even attribute this to science in a very poor way, that scientists, when they finish their experiment or they finish their study, have proven a relationship. Any good scientist would challenge that point and say, no, I didn't prove anything. I suggested a correlation between these two variables, or that there's a relationship between these two particular ideas, concepts, relationships, whatever. It's not proving, it's suggesting evidence for. And that's why it's so important for us to take a step back and really evaluate this idea of proving. Because ultimately, I cannot prove that God exists. I can't do it. I can make proofs. I can make suggestions that certain things follow logically or they have certain levels of cohesion that would recommend that, yes, it's suggestive of God's existence. But ultimately, I can't get to the point where everyone of every time and place would agree, yes, you are right. God is proven. We should all believe in him and blah, 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 we're done. That doesn't work that way. And even for the vast majority of what we deal with, we don't deal with proving. It's amazing to me in our modern society how much we emphasize proving, but how little we can actually prove. Let me give you an example. If I wanted to show that my family cared about me, I would want to set up some sort of evidence to suggest that. Do they seem to show affection? Do they give me gifts? Are they there for me? Do they come when I need? Can I prove that? Can I suggest without a shadow of a doubt that my family actually loves me? Or are they just some sort of masochists who feel like by being nice to me, they treat themselves better? I don't know. Or even in a more existential way. I can't technically prove that I'm speaking to anyone right now, much less that I'm even in the room in which I'm recording. I can make pretty good inference that things aren't the way I anticipate, and therefore it's not my construct, but really speaking, I can't technically prove I'm here. It could all just be a figment of my imagination. I'm just a brain in a vat being stimulated by electrical currents, to the point that I just feel this way. That's why it comes to a very important point when it comes to proving versus finding evidence for, and that is this. It's called thresholds. What a threshold is there's a certain amount of information, evidence, to which the person will say, yes, I believe it. For instance, there was a study done a while ago that suggests this. If three people told me the same thing, or one person told me the same thing 5 times, I would believe it. I'm not sure how valid this particular experiment is, but it shows something about proving, evidence, and thresholds. That at some point, I have set a certain threshold that as a certain number of people have told me that this is true, I would believe it. Although this may seem odd to us that we have thresholds and we have threshold values and that we decide how much evidence we need, it's actually much more common than we think. In the realm of science and statistics, we have a concept called p-values or probability values. What this means is, once we've run the experiment, collected the data, and tried to show a relationship, we use a computer simulation to suggest that there is a relationship between it, such as a line, that as one variable increases, the other one increases, or as one decreases, the other one decreases. As you give more nutrition to a plant, the plant's height increases, for instance. Once the program has decided on a line, it then compares all the points on that line compared to the line, and it says, how far off are these points from that line? Do they deviate so much that it's pretty unlikely that they actually correspond to that line, or are they pretty close, so that the probability that this line refers to this relationship is good? Let me give you an example. At a p-value of 0.5, it suggests that the data are 50% likely to be random, and 50% likely that it forms an actual relationship. Okay, we have a 50-50 chance of actually having conclusive data. Interesting. As a p-value decreases to like 0.2, that means it has a 20% chance of being purely random. At 0.1, 10% chance of being purely random. In the biological sciences, the sciences overall have set a threshold value of 0.05. It means across the board for all the biological sciences that when the experiment shows a relationship value of 0.5 or p-value of 0.5, it means that the study is conclusive. We can suggest a relationship. That means it has a 5% chance of being just random. In the realm of physics, however, they have set the threshold at 0.01, a 1% chance. This is a way that they can decide as a group of scientists that by looking at any particular study, we can look at it and say, yes, this meets the standards. We agree to it. This sets the certain threshold for us that we can all follow. That way, everyone's not setting their own thresholds and everyone's going, well, this one is like this and that one's like that, but we really can't say anything. I don't like this. I don't like that. But there's a standard. The standard helps us to see the same thing with a lot of the rest of our lives, that we do set thresholds for what we'll believe, whether it be on Facebook, how many articles and how many posts of the same article will it take before we say, yes, I agree this is an actual news source, versus how many times will it take before we think that this is a fake news source, or that this is not true. We all have these ideas in our mind of where that threshold is, what is considered sufficient data, what is considered enough information, what is considered the amount I need to be able to suggest this is true, and I will ascribe to it. Certain things are just taken. I just assume I'm in this room, and there's enough evidence to suggest that I'm here. Therefore, I'm going to conclude I am in this room. This is the value and the importance of thresholds, that they give us a way to talk about evidence and talk about proving things in a way that's real and functional. What is my threshold? What will it take for me to believe? Now that we've set kind of a foundation in what I mean by proving and evidence, I want to take a moment and talk about different kinds of evidence and what I mean by evidence, so that we have the same terminology that's being run through this entire conversation. So what I mean by evidence is this. Evidence is information that supports a conclusion or idea. Basically, evidence is always in relation to a conclusion, claim, or idea. It's never just on its own. On its own, it'd be called information. If someone came up to me and said, the sun is hot, I'd be like, great, that's nice. Or if someone came up to me and said, it is 98 degrees outside, I'd be like, great, that's a piece of information. If someone said to me, it's hot outside because it's 98 degrees, and I set my threshold at 100 degrees, I'd say, no, it's not, it's just warm. Once it gets to 100 degrees, it's going to be hot. Therefore, they're making a conclusion, which is, it's hot, based on their evidence that it's 98 degrees. This is the difference between evidence and information. Information is just facts. Evidence is always evidence for a conclusion, claim, or idea. Therefore, when we talk about forms of evidence, we're also going to look at the idea of how valid are they? How useful are they? What good does it bring? Will it be helpful in the grand analysis of things? Or do we need to reevaluate these forms of evidence and suggest something different? First form of evidence, witnesses. Witnesses are both useful and detrimental to finding evidence for a claim. The value of witnesses is you can have quite a number of them. Conversely, there can be very few. Some studies about witnesses have suggested this, that most eyewitnesses are about 60% accurate about the events that have occurred. 60% accurate. That means if I had 5 eyewitnesses, I could trust 3 of them. What do I do with the other 2? Likewise, one of the difficulties with eyewitnesses is they tend to embellish or change events based on their perspective of things. Maybe they're in a different point of view. Maybe they had a moral claim. Maybe they had a relationship status with one of the people involved. All these things will change and color the way people tell a story. Likewise, people don't tell the story as a story. They don't tell a story as a series of facts. They tell a story as a story, which means if someone's telling their experience of a specific event, they're going to tell it from their point of view of what the facts were that are important for telling the basic details of the story. Most people don't go, the car moved 20 feet down the street where it slid 15 feet, and then it hit the curb where it bounced a little bit, hit the person who then fell over, and then by falling over, the person looked like they died, the car stopped, and then it backed up, and then it went 15 feet before driving away. Most people will not tell a story like that. They'd say, the car came careening around the corner where it skidded for a moment, jumped over the curb, hit the person and killed them, and then the guy ran away. Not just facts, there's a little bit of embellishment there. So then in this particular case, can we trust eyewitnesses? Well, the challenge with eyewitnesses and witnesses in general are we can't really refute them unless we have really good claims that their claim is false. Namely, someone's experience of something is their experience, and we're stuck at that. However, when the number of witnesses really increases, there's value there. When we have 100, 500, 1,000, 1,000,000 witnesses, that's pretty powerful. It's hard to diminish 1,000,000 witnesses of an event, even if their stories are slightly skewed or whatnot. Over the course of evaluating all 1,000,000, which sounds horrible, we would eventually get to the point where we'd get a pretty good picture of what they experienced, which is the other big benefit of eyewitnesses. They will always claim that something happened. Something did actually happen. And because something actually happened, we can try to figure out what it was that actually happened, either through their accounts or through more information. Now, in the context of God, looking at the particulars of witnesses, it becomes very challenging. Obviously, there are a ton of people out there, namely 1,000,000,000, who have said they've experienced God to some degree. What do we do with that? Yes, it's something worth paying attention to, because if that many people have the same experience or similar experiences, we ought to pay attention, because it's different than what we anticipate. But in the similar token, what do we do with all those witnesses? How do we compare them, combine them, evaluate them? Is there any evidence of it? Or in another situation with Jesus, where people clearly saw him. We have evidence that people wrote down that they saw him. Now what do we do? Strangely enough, that with Jesus himself, we have quite a bit of evidence to suggest that Jesus actually existed. And what I mean by that is the Roman historian Josephus wrote about a man whose name is Jesus, who was a slave and crucified, and wrote about some of the events of his life. We have several other Roman historians who wrote similar things, suggesting that Jesus actually existed. So if we're trying to say eyewitnesses are useful, these particular accounts would be sources of evidence. Are they enough? We'll have to wait and see. But the main point is eyewitnesses are useful to the extent that they are great in numbers and that we can compare stories. Their drawback is when they get small in number or their stories are largely different, then what do we do? The next source of evidence is called situations. And I get it, this seems a lot like witnesses, and some of these will be very similar. I am making very sharp distinctions so we can really get a sense of the human experience and really gather a sense of how do I evaluate very specific pieces of evidence and also understand the implications of them. The major difference between witnesses and a situation is that situations don't necessarily involve a witness. For instance, if I'm walking through the woods and I see a tree lying on the ground, I don't need an eyewitness to say, "Excuse me, did this tree fall or did someone put it here?" I probably can look at the situation and get a good sense that the tree fell without any eyewitnesses to prove it. And this is the power of situations, that they are external to the eyewitness account, and therefore we can evaluate them based on criteria of science or criteria of investigation. If we see an event that happens, such as a car crash, we are stuck with the end claim. The car is now on the side of the road, probably mangled. What happened? Isn't that the central question for all of this? What happened? I can look at the tire marks, I can look at the way the roads were, I can look at the person, I can look at the situation, such as what was on the road, what was near the road, what was around the road, what might have been happening at that time, and from that I can deduce a conclusion. I can't necessarily prove what happened, but I can get a lot of evidence from the situation, factual evidence, to suggest a certain conclusion. I can suggest that the person hit a piece of ice, ran off the road, and fell into the ditch. Depending on different evidence, I could suggest that the person was drunk and drove off the road. I can say the same thing that if they were falling asleep. All these things are sources that are based on the situation. The nice thing about situations is we can evaluate them from an outside observer perspective, that we don't necessarily need someone to see it, neither do we need kind of this conglomerate of opinions. We have very solid facts that lead us to a conclusion. Unfortunately, in the sorts of situations, the main thing we have in the realm of God and Jesus are miracles. Miracles are hotly contested. How do we understand a miracle? Do they actually exist? What are they? If I were to give a definition for a miracle right now, it would be an act of God to which does not conform to nature. Or, in a better sense, it's an act of God. Therefore, it's not our act. In the case of a miracle, we'd have to be very careful because we do have a situation, such as one guy was in the hospital and he was dying and the next day he was fine. What happened? If the doctors can explain it, awesome, we have a conclusion. If the doctors can't explain it, we have confusion. What do we do? Or if some major event happened, like the sun danced in the sky, what do we do with something like that? We can't look at the situation in of itself. We can't necessarily evaluate what happened. We can look at some sources of evidence and kind of look at a situation, but we're kind of at a loss. And that's where it gets very, very complicated. Miracles only work if we've already presupposed that God exists and there are evidence for him. Otherwise, what they do is they suggest to us that there's something more than our current understanding. Do we need more information? Do we need to wait on it? Is there some other way to explain it? What do we do? In the case of the miracles of Jesus, it gets more trickier because we don't have the physical event itself. We only have suggestions that it happened based on what the people said, which is basically witnesses again. The only way we could look at the events of Jesus' life is to compare them with other events that have happened that may be similar and say, is this plausible? That's the only thing we can do. So largely, situations are challenging and tricky. We're stuck with two things. Something happened. That's the first part. We know something happened that was not what we anticipated. The second thing is, we have to make a hypothesis. What happened? When all of our hypotheses for natural experiments fail, such as this was an event of medication, this was a doctor's help, the person felt better just on their own, once we have dismissed all possible hypotheses, we're stuck with something called the null hypothesis, which was this was a supernatural event, not a natural event. Generally, we want to try and prove every possible idea that it was a natural event before concluding we're stuck with it being a supernatural event. But, largely, situations are complicated. What do we do with the situation when it doesn't conform to what we expect? This next one, I feel like I'm splitting hairs, but I hope you'll take a moment to recognize where I'm going with this, and that is experiences. Experiences are a little bit different than witnesses. Witnesses are based on the person themselves, situations are based on the event itself, experiences are based on the story the person tells. So a witness would be someone saw it and they told a story, and then the situation unfolds as to how we understand the particular event they encountered. Experience, on the other hand, is that someone felt, cognized, thought of, it's difficult to use proper words here, they had some form of an experience that does not fit with our tangible, definable, or concrete situations that would be a witness. Witnesses are concrete situations, experiences are not necessarily concrete. The problem with experiences is that as an experience, we can't necessarily prove against the person's point. We can't deny what they've experienced. We can only hypothesize. Did you really experience that? Maybe the person was delusional, but maybe they also experienced something. We really don't know. We can hypothesize, make conclusions, try to draw other claims, lots of other things, but ultimately we're stuck with the idea that this is someone's actual experience, and that's where we leave it. Hopefully, we can go a little further than that and actually try to validate a claim. Validate that someone had an experience. Validate what their experience was. Maybe there are other experiences people have and we can compare them. That's really useful. But maybe it's just so outlandish, we don't know what to do with it. Then what? Well, let me give you an example. Let's say my friend came up to me and said, "I saw a woolly mammoth." I'd be like, "No, you didn't. They don't exist. They go into extinct." But then, because this is my friend and I kind of trust him, and I'm surprised that he'd be bringing such an outlandish claim, decided to go with him to the place where he saw the woolly mammoth. And lo and behold, by going there, there happens to be the footprint of a woolly mammoth. I can now validate in a different way the claim my friend made about his experience. I'm not bound strictly by the idea that I can only just accept the experience and move on, or dismiss it and move on. But now, I'm hoping to either use more experiences or even situational evidence to try and validate that claim that that person may have actually experienced a woolly mammoth. In the context of God, our challenge is that this particular way of thinking leads us to say, okay, you experienced God, now what? Do I trust my friend's claim? If he's a trustworthy person who has never let me down, maybe I have to. Versus someone who's crazy and I don't know what to think, maybe I don't want to accept their claim. Ultimately, I'm stuck with this is their experience. A lot of experiences together kind of make a picture, but that's all we got. I can't experience Jesus right now in the more physical sense. Neither can I really experience God in the physical sense, to where if you came with me, I'd be like, look, there's God's footprint. Doesn't quite work that way. But there is still something there, much like witnesses and situations. There's something worth paying attention to. Each of us has to decide what that means to us and whether it's worth validating. The next one is completely different from the last three, and it's called reasoned arguments. Yes, even reasoning itself can be a form of evidence. The challenge and complexity of reasoned arguments are twofold. The beauty of it is that they kind of span all people's experiences. We're not bound by what someone experienced or what someone felt or what someone witnessed or even the situation itself, but we have a nice train of thought, a logical argument that we can show to anyone and they can say, yes, these premises are true, therefore I accept your conclusion. Great. We've all validated this particular argument and decided, yes, this is a true conclusion. Doesn't lead to belief. It just leads to the idea that that is a good argument, and therefore we can accept the conclusion. Let me give you an example. Let's say I make this argument. Light is warm. The sun emits light. Therefore, the sun is warm. That's a reasonable argument. You can challenge either of those points, that either light is not warm, or the sun does not emit light. As long as you accept both of those premises, that the light is warm and the sun emits light, you have to accept my conclusion that the sun is warm. Hot, warm, you play with semantics, but the logic still holds. This particular form of arguing is useful for being on the same terms and the same ideas with people, that we can use these things to try and approach greater realities that are not situational. They're beyond us. The problem is we have to make sure we have good logic, sound premises, and it leads to a logical conclusion. Otherwise, we have problems. Now, in the context of God, this has its use. And the use is that several of the arguments for the existence of God are truly reasoned arguments, such as this one. If we accept that in the universe there are causal relationships, that is, one thing causes another. If I push a ball, my act of pushing the ball causes the ball to roll. The ball would not roll if I did not push it. Or if I'm driving down the road and a rock hits my car, I don't go, "Wow, that rock came out of nowhere. Too bad it just kind of keeps falling on me all the time." I would have to assume that something caused the rock to roll, such as a tree fell, or the snow melted, or the gravity pushed on it. Something caused the rock to roll. First one, everything has causes. Second point, causes do not cause themselves. There's nothing in the universe that causes itself. The rock just doesn't roll because it wants to roll. Something has to push it. The car doesn't go because it decides to go. Something has to start it and make it run. The ball doesn't move because it just decides to move. The ball is moved because someone pushes it. Nothing causes itself. Number three. These causes cannot go back infinitely. We can't say that things cause each other in an infinite regression all the way back to eternity. That would be illogical because things are already caused in time. Therefore, since they're caused in time, they also have to have a beginning and an end. As long as they have a beginning and an end, they can't go on infinitely. Neither can they be an infinite loop, because an infinite loop implies something began the loop. And that's where we're stuck, that if there is causes, they cannot go back infinitely because something has to be the first cause. There. 1, 2, 3. First of all, there are causes. Second of all, they can't cause themselves. Third of all, they can't go back infinitely. If there are causes, they cannot cause themselves, and they cannot go back infinitely, something must be the first cause. And that thing that is the first cause must be a cause in and of itself that is beyond time itself. Therefore, I have a logical argument that if you accept my premise that things are caused, or accept the premise that things don't cause themselves, and accept the premise that things cannot go back infinitely, you must accept my conclusion that there must be a first cause that caused everything that is in of itself a cause. That is how a reasoned argument works for God. We can challenge that. We can work with it. Physics in the modern era has concluded some things regarded causes that it might not be the way we anticipate. We'll have to wait and see what their conclusions result in. But this is how logical arguments work. The only problem with logical arguments of this kind is they only suggest something. They get us to the point to say, yeah, that could work. Yeah, that seems logical. Now what? And now we're stuck. So they're useful to an extent of being able to talk about something, but not useful in the sense of really good, solid evidence that will lead us to some different conclusions. The last one is easier to understand, but more complicated to use. It is experiments. We can do experiments on things. We can go and do a survey of people in two different cities to find out what their likings are. And I can do it again after I finish that survey to see if it's valid. The beauty of experiments is that we set a hypothesis to try and find a relationship, and we can repeat it. We can do it again and again and again and hope for the same results to further validate the hypothesis that I started out with. For instance, if I wanted to find out if people liked whole milk over 1% milk, and I ran a survey, and I found out that 20% of people liked 1% milk over whole milk, and I ran the survey again and found 18%, ran it again and found 30%, I'm getting similar results from the same experiment, and now it's repeated. It's not just one event and done, neither is it based on my experience or the situation. It's now repeated. This is great on many levels. The repeatability of an experiment allows us to see things in a more broader and confirmed context. It takes more time and energy, but it really is related to physical things and experiences. In relation to God, this is not easy, if not, I would argue, impossible. How can we experiment on God? It would be like this. You sit there and pray for a miracle. You pray for a miracle. We'll see if you both get your miracle. What? Believe it or not, these experiments have been done. They have done things such as brain scans while people are praying. They've also done tests while people are praying to see if it helps the patient they're praying for or hinders them. All these things are attempts, but we ultimately don't have the same control. We're always dealing with this fact that God does what God wants if this is going to be true, and therefore we can never control what God is doing. It's only a social experiment about whether people feel good when people are praying for them or don't. We largely cannot experiment on God or Jesus. That being said, there is one form of experimentation that's a little bit different and worth bringing in. There is one form of experiment we can run in a very strange and complicated way. It's called the tuning hypothesis. The way it works is if we look at the universe as a whole and the way that everything operates, it suggests that things are so minutely and finely tuned that it can't be by chance alone. That even if the constants of the universe are off by a mere fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a number, like 0.0001, the whole universe would fall apart. The idea that it's so fine-tuned, and we can repeat that and show that particular way of thinking, that kind of is a form of experiment. We'll have to play with that one, and you can decide what you think of it. So now that we've kind of addressed some of these points, we've looked at different forms of evidence between witnesses, situations, experiences, experiments, and logical arguments, we have to put the pieces together. Is there any evidence for God or Jesus? A very central and important question, and the question of today. I argue that there is evidence. There's stuff out there that suggests that God exists. Whether it proves it is a totally different question. We can't technically prove it. But look at some of the things we've discussed so far. People have witnessed, they are eyewitnesses of events that they claim God came to meet them, or that they have witnessed things God has done. What do we do with that? Or what about people who have situations that are odd, like miracles? We got to do something with that. Or experiences. People have visions, or they see things, or they get locutions. These are not normal. And they're not necessarily psychological disorders either. There's something different of itself. And that's why we need to pay attention to it. We can make reasoned arguments. I made a few of them already that suggest that there must be a God because of the way the universe is. Either the first cause argument that started with because the universe has causes, we can suggest that there's a first cause, or even the fine-tuning argument that suggests that the universe is so finely tuned that it's not just by random or by happenstance. And lastly, what do we do with the plethora of people who have been bound by these religious ideas or have been experiencing them? Something we need to play with. Before I end, I want to talk about two different concepts that kind of color this picture a little bit more. The first one I'm talking about is love. Yep, love. We largely accept and believe in the existence of love. We even believe that several people love us. Can we prove love? Yes, from a psychological perspective, we can say that person seems to have affection towards them because they have some sort of look, or they give gifts, or they seem to be friendly. We have all these inferences based on what we experience that suggest those people are in love. But it could just be that that person really hates the other person, is trying to be nice. Or they really want something from that person, so they're going to act like they're in love for the sake of getting what they want. It's almost impossible for us to truly prove love, the existence of love, the fact that someone loves, the fact that we are loved. It's kind of something we just accept as an experience, as some form of witness or a situation. And for that reason, we just assume that we are loved. I would largely agree that, for the most part, this would be true, that people do love one another and really want to give oneself to the other and really do care about each other. But when we talk about proving or even finding evidence for, How is this different than finding evidence for God? How does it change our mind to know that we can't really prove love, and yet we just accept it? On a similar note, I want to talk about faith. Faith is a very important concept in this particular setting because it reminds us of one thing. Even if I were to ascribe that there is a creator God, that there is this one who is the first cause, that doesn't mean I care. It just means that I've reached a logical conclusion and it seems to be holding well, and therefore I accept it, that this must be the way things are. Logical conclusions or even suggestive of evidence doesn't get us to any point in which God becomes a belief or a point of faith. We're still stuck in the mentality that, okay, this is the way I think. I don't have any reason to go any further. I don't know what to make of this evidence, so I'm just going to suggest that it might be the case. Versus faith, which is a assent of our will to say, yes, God not only exists, but he matters in my life, and I want to do something about that. This is the ultimate reason why we can't really prove the existence of God. That faith is such a strong core of it, that without faith, we'd all ultimately just accept God, and we wouldn't even be asking this question to begin with. If we all just were given the gift to know God's existence, this question is null. We just know it. No sense of proving. But because we don't all agree, we don't all believe, we now have a reason to ascribe to something different. We now have to wonder, ponder, contemplate. What do I need to do to believe? Is there any way that I would actually believe, or am I in such a situation where my threshold is so high that no amount of proof will ever make it work? No amount of evidence will ever suggest God's existence? Or have I experienced something where my threshold is so low that I just ultimately accept it? This is now where we are stuck. Is there evidence to suggest that God or Jesus exists? Yes. There is evidence. Is it enough? Thank you for listening. Join us every week for a new question to ponder. If you have any questions from today's episode, feel free to email me at cwilliams@ctkmsla.org. Now You Know is hosted and edited by Father Cody Williams. Music for today's episode is provided by freemusicarchive.com. A special thanks to the artist England for today's music.